Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I'm Frank.
I'm Rhonda.
Hello, Rhonda.
Hello, Frank. How you doing?
I'm good. Good. Yeah, I feel good. A little overwhelmed.
I know.
A little overwhelmed, but I mean, just to drill it down, just overwhelmed with my reading schedule, because I have book discussions and then the podcast, and then, you know, I'm always trying to, because I'm such an anxious reader sometimes, like I just need to focus and on one book, like I've always said, and I sort of got bollocksed up with a couple of reading commitments that are pleasures, pure pleasures, but and then, you know, when you decide to read a book, you don't know what you're, at least I don't. I prefer not to. I don't know what I'm getting into, per se. Like, I don't know what it's going to require of me. And the book I read for, that I wanted to read for this podcast, was a lot more challenging than I thought it would be.
Ooh.
I mean, I don't know what I thought it would be, but it required a focus that was in, as any listener of this podcast would know, is in quite short supply in my brain sometimes.
So. I feel like that's everyone right now, though.
Yeah, well, good. Actually, you know, usually I like to be unique and special, but now I'm glad you actually said that, because it made me feel like I sort of knew that was true. Like, everyone's a little foggy.
Oh, yeah.
And overwhelmed, and maybe now with a sense of relief. But I don't know. So, yeah, it was a challenge, as they say in French.
I've not heard that word. What does it mean?
I just made it up. I'm just saying challenge in a French accent.
I heard that? No, I feel the same way. My mind has been all over the place, which I will also talk about when we get to why I chose the book that I chose.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Yes. It's been a struggle.
A lot of meaning. I mean, like, you know, we don't have to be coy about it, and I don't have to go first, but like I read a book that I had never read, but has been on my list literally for like since college, like a billion decades. It's a fairly famous book. It is a famous book called The Memoirs of Hadrian by Marguerite Yourcenar, published in 1951, and it's about a Roman emperor. And I really wanted to, it came in my mind amongst other titles of, I think I was casting about for a book on leadership. I wanted to read a book on a leader. I wanted to read a book that I'd heard was well reviewed and revered and might have something to say about what it is to be in charge of a people and of a country, that kind of thing. So I read Memoirs of Hadrian, and there's so much in there. There's so much in there. So I don't know. But what about you?
I'm gonna say the book. Okay. I don't know if you've had this experience, but I know you've had some like reading commitments, but kind of in the past 2 weeks since we talked, I think my mind has kind of been all over the place, and like you said, kind of had it in trouble focus. So I actually started like three different books, and I couldn't focus on like one book. Like, I couldn't focus on a novel. Like, I just couldn't get through the whole thing, even though the books that I started were good books and they were popular books, and I was enjoying them, but I just couldn't focus. I couldn't commit to like a long story. So I chose a short story that I focused on, because I've been doing a little bit of research on W.E.B. Du Bois. And I found in one of his books that he had written a science fiction story, which I thought was very intriguing that Du Bois had written science fiction. There was a story called The Comet. And again, like you said, like there's a lot in the book that you chose, but I feel like there was, even though this story is really short, it's actually like 10 pages, there's a lot packed into this short story, but it's Du Bois, so I'm like, okay, that makes sense. But
that's the thing. I'm gonna jump in here, because as we were saying before we got on, is that it doesn't matter really the length of a book. I tell the patrons that all the time, and it matters like what's it suggests to you and what's packed in it and what the author is trying to do. Because, you know, like we were saying, like, oh, let's do poetry because it's short. And then you start reading the poem. And like when I read Deaf Republic, the long form poem, I read it like a couple of days before the podcast. And there's so much there that I couldn't really focus on. And I did a terrible podcast about that book because I was sort of still at sea about what I thought about it because there was so much there. So it's not about length. Size doesn't matter here. But tell me a little bit about W.E.B. Du Bois.
So Du Bois is kind of one of those, you know, titans in African-American history because, you know, he was one of the founders of the NAACP. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And he was just kind of, he was a Pan-Africanist working, you know, in Ghana. He wrote kind of his, I guess what's kind of become part of the canon, the Souls of Black Folk. Mm-hmm. He was a very prolific writer. He wrote for the Crisis magazine, which is the magazine of the NAACP. He attended Fisk and Harvard and the University of Berlin, and just kind of there for the early 20th century at every pivotal moment of the early civil rights and the anti-lynching movement.
Yeah.
And he actually, I believe, he died in Ghana. He ended up leaving and going and living in Ghana. But you know, he was just a very, very prolific writer. He came up with the idea of the talented 10th, talking about the importance of education and the leadership of those people who have had this education. So, you know, there's a lot to Du Bois. And, you know, he wrote so much, but most people, I think, know the Souls of Black Folk.
Yeah, I didn't know he was such a writer that he diversified into science fiction.
I think most people don't know that because I definitely didn't know that. And honestly, I don't know if he has written any, I don't believe he's written more science fiction. It could just be this one story.
Really?
Yeah. But I like it? this little, like you said, how he has diversified the type of writing.
How did you come across the story?
So it's in an anthology of his called Dark Water, which is a collection of his writings that he published, and it's kind of, you know, from The Atlantic that he wrote for, from The Crisis. There's some poetry that he wrote that's in here. And then the very last thing that's in this anthology is The Comet, the short story. And people call Dark Water kind of, I guess, the sequel, the follow-up to Souls of Black Folk. It was written about 10 years after Souls of Black Folk came out. The whole title's Dark Water, Voices from Within the Veil. And
Within the Veil?
Within the Veil. And that's a reference from Souls of Black Folk that I remember, kind of writing from behind the veil. Mm. And I'm not going to try to go too deep into that because I don't know as much about Du Bois as I probably should. But this is, some people call this his militant sequel to Souls of Black Folk, but so I was kind of going through this and found The Comet. Yeah. So I don't know, should I jump into it or should we start with the memoirs?
Of Hadrian. Here we go with our like polite sort of, no, you
I know, I don't know.
I mean, do you want to go first? I hate this. You go first and I'll talk. It's a conversation. We're sitting at a cafe table. We're having coffee. So it's not like, do you want to go first? You'd just be talking, right?
I know.
So get out of my way. I'm going to talk first.
Okay, let's hear about the memoirs.
I'm just going to do it.
Do it.
I know. I hate that sort of like, do you want to go first? I always say this, but I hope like won't be long-winded about it. I could just be like short-winded about it. And then you could talk about Du Bois. But like I said, I wanted to read about leader. I hate the word leader, though, in a way, because it implies, I don't know what it implies. I don't somehow like what it implies, but there are leaders, I guess, literally. So I wanted to read about one, and I had always heard about this book, and I just thought it would be sumptuous and well-written. And it's by Marguerite Yourcenar, who's French, and she's the only woman who was admitted into the French Academy because of this book, and like a real literary hoity-toity establishment in France. Mm-hmm. And she translated, though, in collaboration with her partner, Grace Frick. So the translation issue, she was also involved in the translation, which also pleases me, because when you're reading translated works, we've talked about this before, mm-hmm. you're almost reading another author's view on another author's writing. So she wrote it over a period of 25 years or more. And honey, it shows, because each page is, and this is what I meant about length and when you take on something, and I think I took on a lot more than I could chew, but each page is sort of packed with insights and meditations on everything from cooking to running a country or running an empire or rights of civilians or, you know, your constituents. And after 20 pages, I literally would, like, my eyes would sort of glaze over because I couldn't take it in. Like, it was a lot. So I really, but I liked it. I could only read in 20 page increments, and then I needed to pause and like ruminate and just breathe. So I, you know, didn't set myself up for a lot of time. It's a book that you could pick up almost anywhere and start reading because of its format and because of its direction. And what its format basically is Hadrian the Emperor's a monologue. It's in the form of a letter he's writing to Marcus Aurelius, who is will eventually be a successor of Hadrian as a ruler of the Roman Empire. So it's all his voice, first person, talking to ostensibly Marcus Aurelius, but really talking to all of us. So, and it's just about, here's my life. I was born, I did this, and now I'm on my way to die, because he's writing it sort of on his deathbed. So once you get the general idea, it's going to be like an emperor's journey. You sort of, and there's a lot of mention of like different sovereignties and states and battles and things like that. That's, to me, in my head, which I have a hard time with, like battles and politics. Like, I never understand, like, wait, how did they take over that plot of land again? Like, who is deceived who, or who, how did this actually happen? Like, politics is hard for me to understand, even though it's essentially just like interpersonal relationships writ large in a way. But so Hadrian was born in 76 AD. So he was primarily, he was an emperor in the second century, which is like almost 1,000 years ago. It's amazing to think. And Marguerite Yourcenar wrote this. There's very little known about Hadrian. There's not a lot that survives. There are a couple of famous works that were written contemporaneously. Anyway, do you get the backstory?
I do. So since there's not a lot written on it, she has just use some artistic license to fill in points.
Great question, because that's the whole thing about historical fiction, because it is a novel.
Right.
Okay. Is that she did like oodles and oodles and oodles of research over 25 years. Like, you know, she considers herself having done the job, done the work. But in any historical novel, there is an element of creative license. There sort of has to be, depending on the author's imperative. Like, how much they want to take license with and how much they don't. And she felt she hewed very closely to history. So there's not a lot of first person narrative about Hadrian himself that he wrote. Like I said, there's some contemporaneous stuff and of course history. It's like digging, you do a lot of research. Mm-hmm. But you like, you know, she can't know what he was thinking at any given moment. She can't know how he felt about a certain battle. I mean, there are decisions to be made. And that's an interesting process to read about it, because we'll never know, really, unless I guess some archaeological discovery emerges, which I don't know will happen. So Hadrian was considered like one of the good emperors. Like his reign, which is about 20 years from 40 to 60, and he died at 62, was like a good one. not like Nero, which was like debauched and violent and horrible. And Hadrian made some good choices in that, at least I thought so. Like when he took over the empire, because the empire stretched from like Britain down to Egypt, you know, over to the east, he actually divested the empire of certain provinces because he felt he couldn't manage them. Which okay. Anyone who's a manager will sort of get, like, but yet it seems scandalous because you sort of want the most power you can get and then you just figure out how to work it. Wow. It takes a wise manager to sort of say, like, you know what, I can't take that on. It's like the power of saying no, I can't take that on because it's going to be too much and I want to focus on the people that are you know, in this part of my empire. And not because it before he took over, his predecessor had taken annexed these sovereignties and to add to the Roman Empire. And then Hadrian took over and he's like, no, it's too much. I don't need to deal with that. And so it was controversial. I mean, what I find interesting about, and I said this before too, like being a manager of a facility and a staff is like being an emperor or a president or a ruler in some ways writ much smaller, because it's the same issues you have to deal with, pleasing your constituents, getting something to run well. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's all kinds of managers and things like that. So like how one makes one's choices, because in those days, which 1,000 years ago, he also in the same, on the other hand, executed a whole bunch of administrators in the empire that he felt were against him.
Is that normal? What? I feel like it's a story you hear about a lot of Roman emperors. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that was normal.
But he wasn't like
a lot of people.
He wasn't considered one of the bad ones, but yet that's what's challenging to talk about this, because there was a benevolence. But like in any leader's life or any ruler, president, prime minister, whoever is designated the person in charge, there's never going to be an unequivocal agreement on how they performed. There's always going to be something that doesn't please someone, of course. So, and also culture of the times, like, what does that mean? Because Hadrian also expounds about women and slavery, and he talks about how he thinks it's absurd that women don't have control over their lives or have any degree of power, because as he's experienced it, women have a great deal of power in daily life, in life. So he gave women rights of property owning and administering of money. Plus, he also made it illegal to force a woman into marriage against her will, which was apparently before that acceptable. But then it again asks the question, when you really think about it, it's something we think about today, like what gives someone the right to decide? Okay, I'm going to let you have rights. Basically saying, I'm going to let you have rights. And in those days, an emperor was practically a deity. It was like a god.
Exactly.
Certainly deified after they died. They built temples to them and it was like they're celebrities. But yet when you really think about it, it's like we're letting someone, we're almost agreeing to say, okay, we're going to put you in charge and we're going to trust you're going to administer rights to us fairly, but we're ultimately going to have to accept what you do in some ways. Mm-hmm. Hadrian called it, which keeps coming to mind, a regulated liberty, which is a really interesting concept, because he also talks about slaves and he said, you know, slaves have to have a say in their life and in their country, in their empire, in the empire, because he felt, and this is like a managerial 101, like if they didn't have buy-in to their life, then they wouldn't care. And if they did have buy-in to their life, it would only add to the greater glory of the empire. Meaning it did. And I guess in some ways it doesn't matter if a slave cares or not, because they're a slave and they told what to do, but he was concerned with their psyche, that they would be satisfied and motivated. I mean, doesn't that sound like how to manage your employees and one easy lesson?
Go ahead. I was just thinking about,
There's
a lot here. I'm gathering my thoughts.
Go ahead. Gather. Because then to continue with what I said about how someone regulates liberty, that yet he still believed fully in slavery. Meaning right. People were slaves, and from all over the empire, whoever they conquered. So he wanted them to have rights, but yet they were still known and considered to be slaves. I mean, there's a scene where Hadrian's going to the office to, like, you know, write a dictate or something, and one of his assistants annoys him, and usually does annoy him, but that day he annoyed him particularly well, awfully, and Hadrian raises his hand to strike the slave / assistant and hit him in the eye or in the face, and he says, "Oops, I didn't realize I had a pen or stylus in my hand," and it basically puts out the slave's eye, the assistant's eye. But then Yourcenar writes what followed after is that Hadrian felt terribly about it. And when the slave comes back to work, he goes, you know, "How much did it cost to, you know, get your eye taken care of? And what can I do to make it up to you?" He actually says this to the slave. Isn't he sweet? And then the slave, sure. Actually, Yourcenar writes that the slave says, "Well, I'd rather have my eye back." And then Hadrian goes, it basically is sort of like, "Watch yourself." You know, I'm trying to make amends here, but watch yourself, because nobody asks, you know, sometimes stuff happens and deal with it. And I was just like, what an interesting power relationship that we experience all the time in lots of ways, about, like, he felt emboldened enough to say, "Well, I'd rather have my eye, but I'd like to be snarky."
Right.
Basically, Hadrian could have had him executed immediately for whatever reason he wanted. In those days, that could easily happen. But he didn't do that like other emperors did, even though, of course, he did execute people. And this is the core. Did you want to say something, like, you were gathering your thoughts?
Yeah, I was just thinking. And then also in terms of slavery, I don't know a lot about what slavery was like during the Roman Empire. And I'm assuming that maybe they saw their slaves as humans, and maybe that has something to, I don't know. I was just thinking, you know, reading about leaders, as you said, it's so important to kind of understand what the times were like to really understand the person and the leadership. So those were just thoughts that were kind of going through my head as you were talking, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems that Hadrian and, you know, a lot of leaders throughout history thought slavery was a necessity to get things done, that it was something that had to exist to get things. And also probably as a message to enemies, a whole bunch of things. I mean, you know, yeah, well, I was going to divert, but I won't. As a message to enemies, and also as a way to get things done cheaply.
Right.
He, you know, is considered benevolent in that he felt that they had to have some rights and buy into the society in which they were enslaved, but ultimately they were enslaved. So it's an interesting journey in this book to find out what this guy was really like what really motivated him. And because like I said before, he could have executed the sassy slave. It's a terrible thing to say. With the eye, that he knocked his eye out. if he felt like it, because he could. And, you know, there can be consequences, but
of course
it wasn't just like rampant. Well, it was rampant brutality, but you never know where the consequences will come. Like sometimes an enemy will, it'll turn the tide and they'll go after you if they didn't like what you did. So, like, for people. So what makes him and what's interesting, and what makes him benevolent, like, why would he do the things he did? Because he is considered good. And what motivates him, and what is interesting is that he doesn't seem to be motivated, Hadrian, from reading this book, by altruism or doing, he wanted to do good for people. It was, and it wasn't even a moral imperative per se, or maybe it verges on more a moral imperative. It was more just like a dispassionate, like, he was so detached in a way from people that he could almost do what he did because there was no crazy passions fueling him in terms of one way or the other. You could say that, or you could say it was just a brain, his mind impelled him to do right, or as right as he could by people, because that was something his mind compelled him to do. And he didn't, in quotes, have a choice. Like so he did a lot of good, as I somewhat delineated, but also could do whatever he wanted. Like he did execute people. He did feel like he could strike an assistant if he was annoying him. You know, he certainly had a million mistresses and had a wife he didn't really get along with. It was, of course, like a political match and could do what he want. But like that sense of there is a sense, and that goes back to why it was tough for me to read, because I sort of realized I get into passionate people reading about them. And he really is a sort of detached. He didn't care about the love of the people either. Like he wasn't doing it for that motivation, but it's hard to figure out what he was doing it for. It was almost just like a belief, and it was almost secondhand. Like he just felt it was an absurdity to not do what he saw clearly before his eyes, which was other people existed outside of himself and therefore were entitled to some degree the same rights accorded to everyone else. And this book is interesting because it doesn't really deal with an inner life. And maybe that's why I'm struggling, because it doesn't deal with his inner life per se. It's more like the pontifications and meditations of someone who's in charge, without a lot of revelation of what's impelling him inside. I mean, you know, you could write about a leader and say they did this, they did that, they succeeded, they failed, but you know, he was still a person and, you know, and pray to that. And he also knew that, like he knew that he shouldn't be deified, but yet, because he's just a human being like a peasant, but he did allow himself to be considered a godlike, because hey, why not? And
I mean, he was a god technically to the human people, right? So that's what they considered
the emperor. And you know,
I'm assuming that he also believed that then.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that he didn't believe it fully, but yet you cannot remain unchanged if everyone around you for 20 years is basically revering you and considering you godlike. You cannot. Mm. Like his striking of that assistant, or the abuse of whoever he felt like was not on his side. I mean, like, you have to have a sense of that deification. And also, I think part of his personality craved that. Oh, there's a great quote, which I find so interesting. It might be the closest to capture a motivation. He says about his hunger for power. He says, I needed to be assured of reigning, meaning it needed to be shown to me that I was fully in charge, that I was reigning the empire. He needed that in order to capture the desire to serve. Isn't that cool? Because when we think of people who serve, like people who serve the community, or people whose jobs or purposes are to serve others, we think of it as very philanthropic and altruistic, and very well, maybe, and lots of people. But he, and this is what makes the book intriguing, is that, and this is what's very much about what's dense about the book too, is that in the one sentence or one paragraph, he will say a thing and then will qualify it with something else. So he never quite says, this is who I am. He'll say, this is who I am, but I'm also possibly this. And like it's exhibited in this statement. Like, how many people could, I don't think I could, like, figure out about themselves, like, I need to be fully in charge and I crave complete domination. And only when I'm sure assured of that complete domination can I actually serve you. I mean, how many people would sort of say, that's my motivation to serve you, because I'm fully in charge and I can chillax because I know that I'm in charge. Whereas most people would be like, I empathize with people, I care about people, and I want to help them. And I actually have always secretly thought a lot of people that do help other people, I mean, like we do, we're librarians, secretly like being that dominant figure. I mean, it's nothing bad to say. It's just interesting to say, or it could be bad if it's abused, but I find it very, it for someone to realize that about themselves is pretty sort of interesting, right? Don't you think?
It is. It's.
Does it bother you?
You know, I think it's complicated because I don't know how Hadrian came into power, but it seems like people who want, especially political leaders and political types, I just find it always kind of intriguing what their motivations are, because in my opinion, I think that's a job that I would actually never want to be in a place of political leadership, but because I feel like you have a very specific type of personality. But I do think it probably is that mix of, okay, I want to have this power of being a leader of this large group of people, but at the same time, there might be some element of public service to it as well. So, yeah. You know, thinking about people who are in these roles.
I know. I always want to find out how they did what they did, how they became what they became. And, you know, like, look at their childhood, and that doesn't always really, there's never a through line necessarily between childhood and what you become as an adult. We might force it there, but I'm not sure it's realistic all the time, because I feel like you come into the world with some proclivity towards something, and your life can mitigate that or exacerbate it as it does. But I like personally is that unexpected but honest and statement that to our brains now, it doesn't sound very nice to say I needed complete domination in order to serve. And he certainly did serve. He traveled more than any other Roman emperor, because he wanted to be among the people. He wanted them to see them, and he knew by that, but he knew by them seeing him all the time, he would have greater power over them, because he wasn't remote and they couldn't, like, you know, play while the cat's away kind of thing.
Right.
And he wasn't just like a Sybarite in Rome, just enjoying this sort of cosmopolitan life there. He was like on the road with the military all the time of the people. But again, an imperative is of his own. I mean, I think he, in a way, was so resistant to the idea of anyone dominating him, that he needed to feel completely and solely in charge, but yet that dominance turned into a benevolence of sort rather than a cruel reign, you know? Yeah. I mean, but again, you're right. How does one become who they are?
Right.
I really think there's an area that we could never know, that's just that confluence of genetics, upbringing, situation, and
just the culture that they're in, you know, the Roman Empire and all that entailed, you know, and being,
but that's a good point, because like technically we don't know what it was exactly like, but you're in a world where the emperor has a lot of power to do whatever they feel like. There aren't as many checks and balances on them beyond almost like subterfuge and, like, you know, they'll poison you in your sleep, which is probably a pretty powerful deterrent. But yet you could say execute, kill, banish. I mean, there's a story where he had a woman banished because she treated her slaves badly, because he didn't like the fact that she was abusing them for no reason other than just to be cruel. And so he was like, you're out. He didn't kill her, but he banished her. I mean, like, you know, things like that. Like that when you really think about these specifics, it's like crazy. But he has some, just to top it off, he has some, well, interesting quotes that I had noted, like that I thought were salient for today. He said, if you show tolerance to fanatics, they construe this as sympathy to their cause. Which is an interesting, I mean, do you realize how much is in that statement? Like, if you show
tolerance. And it sounds like something a leader would say, you know, there's some insight that they would have.
They construe this as sympathy to their cause. And he does say something which is very much like applicable to any error. He goes, political newcomers, meaning people new to the political scene, were not so different from the rulers. they were chiefly less soiled by actual possession of power. So he's basically saying by possession of power, you're going to get corrupt.
Of course. Somewhat. Yeah.
And so there was really no difference, except they just hadn't had experience with power yet. So they weren't quite as dirty. I mean, stuff like that. It's a journey that takes time, this book. There's also like a very famous like sort of companion he had, like a young boy who became his companion in later life, Antinous, who died mysteriously or was killed himself. And then for reasons not fully known, but much talked about, Hadrian deified this peasant boy all over the empire. And the images of Antinous are some of the only surviving sculptures and images from the Roman Empire, because he did so much of them. And it is said, like, you know, and it ties into what I was analyzing Hadrian as before, is that he could have been able to sacrifice the boy to Hadrian, because there was also a belief that one person's death could lead to another person's longevity. And of course that person's longevity would be the emperor. Or Antinous killed himself for that reason. So, and then out of almost delayed gratification, Hadrian deified this kid because he felt so close to him when he was alive, but couldn't fully express that because he didn't like feeling emotionally dominated by any particular feeling. It became a almost like expiation after Antinous died of that need to honor him. So it's like, I don't know. But it's a complicated book. And it's also just, when you think you have, I'll finish with this. Like, when you think you understand him, you get a whole new passage that sort of illuminates another aspect of his personality. And you're like, that doesn't jibe. You're like, you get this fair-minded, loving or interesting person who loved the arts. And then he's like, yeah, and I executed X, Y, and Z. And then you have, like you said, you have to think about the culture in which you live, but still it's a lot to wrap your head around.
It sounds like it. I have to commend you for jumping into that book during this day and age.
Thank you, darling.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I know. I'm always wanting to challenge myself, even though I'm like 10 steps from the grave, for God's sake.
No, but I've always kind of had a interest in the Roman Empire, but definitely Hadrian is one that I did not know. I mean, I've heard of Hadrian's Wall. I know that was...
Yeah, it was one of the things he built as a barrier of the empire from, you know, the outside forces.
Yeah.
And but his villa.
He's far removed from the ones that I think most people know of, like Nero and
Caligula
and...
Yeah, because he wasn't a crazy debauched creep.
He
could get it on when he felt like it, but as an emperor is entitled to do. But he primarily was a peaceful reign. There were no wars when he was in charge. It was more about fortifying the empire as it was. But he did not cause wars. He wanted to stop them. Actually, he just thought it was just like a waste of time. But one more point. I'm sorry. I could keep going on, because that's another thing. When you think you're actually doing a good thing, like much is made of this in the book. You think you're doing a good thing by saying, I'm not going to start wars with people. We have a huge empire. We're going to maintain the empire and make everyone's quality of life better. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great thing. Who could argue with that, right? The military were pissed at him because they were like, now we have no opportunities. We're not doing what we're trained to do. We're just going to sit around and just sort of protect the barriers. We want to go to war. That's our job. And so he had a problem with the military for a while. And that's partly why he traveled so much. He was like always with the military, because he was like, you guys, I want to show you're appreciated, but we're not going to war. And they were sort of a little resentful. I mean, you can't please everybody, Rhonda.
Right. No, you can't please everyone. But and again, thinking about the significance of the military in that time period, I could see how that could ruffle some feathers. There's a lot of interesting history here.
Thank you.
To dig into.
All right. Now we need to know about Du Bois's science fiction foray.
Science fiction. So Yeah, let's do this. The like I said, the story is in his anthology or collection of writing, Dark Water Voices from Within the Veil. And it's the last, and I actually haven't read the rest of it. I was just kind of flipping through and I saw this and it just kind of intrigued me. And I plan on going back, but I don't believe that all that these writings are related to each other. They're, you know, publications from different magazines and things that he had written for. And then he has poetry. And then he has this short story called The Comet. And this was written, I think, around 1919. So about 10 years after, like I said, The Souls of Black Folk.
It's also right in the middle of a pandemic.
Exactly, right in the middle of a pandemic, yes.
And the end of World War One. Okay.
And the end of World War One, which is interesting because none of these things are in the story.
Right.
But yes, all of that was happening at the time. So it was a really, and yeah, like you said, a very interesting time. And so the story basically starts with this man who I guess is our protagonist, and we don't know his name. They just call him the messenger or the man. And he's a Black man, and it does take place in New York City. And, you know, we start with him walking to work, and he's a messenger, I guess, in a bank or some kind of big institution like that. And you kind of get the feeling of his on his walk to work and kind of seeing his thoughts that he's kind of definitely unhappy or really kind of disgruntled about his place in the world, kind of talking about how he's invisible, how no one really sees him. And then as he's having these thoughts walking to work, kind of you hear, he picks up little pieces of conversation on the street, and everyone's talking about the comet. Like, this comet is going to come that afternoon at like noon, and everyone in New York City is going to be able to see this comet, and everyone's excited about the comet. And so he kind of picks up this, you know, piece of conversation, but he himself is not really thinking at all about this comet. And he goes to work, which I said, it doesn't really say what he does, but you know, there the manager of whatever this place is telling him, you know, you have to go to this vault and kind of get these things for us. And apparently this vault is like old and dirty, and he's thinking, of course they're going to send me, no one cares about, you know, I'm insignificant, so of course I'm the one who's sent to this vault. And he goes into the vault to do whatever they're asking him to do, and of course that's when the comet hits. And you know, he hears the loud boom, and he's coming out of the vault, and it's just carnage, right? There's just dead bodies,
oh my God,
everywhere. No one is alive. And I am going to digress a little bit here. And I don't know if this is the beginning of this type of story, but this is something that in popular culture, especially for those who love like horror and science fiction, is not kind of an uncommon storyline.
Well, I kept thinking of that famous Twilight Zone episode.
Yes, exactly. That was the first thing I thought of when he goes into the vault.
And it's the end of the world.
Yeah,
and when exactly. He comes out, it's like everyone's gone. And actually, it's that one where he then can now read every book in the world because he always just wanted to read books.
Right, and then it's a sad ending.
And then right, and then he drops his glasses.
He
can't read because his glasses are destroyed. He has nothing but time and books. It's terrible.
I know.
But that's what I was thinking of when you were talking. So anyway, all right. So
I thought of that too, and I also thought of the 1980s horror film Night of the Comet. I don't know if you saw that one. And it's very similar that this comet comes and basically destroys everyone except for these teenagers. It's an 80s horror film.
It's always teenagers. And,
yeah, the teenagers. And like the few people who've been exposed to it and survived, of course, are like these weird monster things. It's, you know, I don't know, but it made me think of that. So anyway, he's in this, he comes out and it takes him a while to kind of realize what has happened. And then he kind of says, okay, I have to pull it together because there's something that I have to do. And we don't know what it is, but you kind of assume that, okay, maybe he has someone that he's looking for. And he goes and he's like, okay, I have to get myself together. And he goes into this restaurant to eat. And you see this kind of throughout the stories that he has these flashes of what it was kind of like as to be, I guess, a Black man in America. Like, he'll go into this restaurant to take food, and he thinks, you know, just yesterday, they would have never, ever let me in here. Oh. And he has these kind of flashes as he's going through, because he's like, okay, I have to get to Harlem. I'm going to take the train. He's like, wait a second, I'm going to take a car, because, you know, his car's on the street. So he gets a car, and he's starting to drive, and then he hears, like, these cries for help, and someone else is alive. And it turns out that, so he stops and he goes to look for this woman, and it's a white woman, and a white woman who is very kind of wealthy and privileged. And she was in a dark room kind of, you know, developing some film, and she survived. So we have this kind, you know, we have this 1919, only people left on earth is this very wealthy white woman and this, this Black man, the messenger. So there's already a lot to dissect just right there with, like, okay, here are the last two people.
You know, by the way, there was a movie from the 50s called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil about the end of the world. And the two survivors were Harry Belafonte and Inger Stevens, a white actress. So I wonder if they borrowed from that story. But anyway, now it we got these two set up. Okay.
Yeah, so, and then we kind of begin to see the evolution of their thought process to the story. So first, they're just so happy to not be the only two, right? So they're not immediately thinking about, oh, this is a very wealthy white woman, and this is a Black man, and they're not adhering to what the cultural norms would probably be during that time. You know, he would probably have to, you know, show deference to her, but she's like, you know, you have to take me to find my father. And he's like, no, I'll take you, but we're going to Harlem first. So that might've been, you know, so at the beginning, they're kind of not behaving as they probably would in under the normal circumstances. But then, you know, so they go to Harlem, they go to find her father, and they just can't find anyone. And they're driving around, and they can't find anyone. So they decide to go to, you know, this is 1919, this place where they have switchboards, I guess, where you would make all the phone calls. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to reach people across the world, and they can't reach anyone. And this is kind of a turning point, I guess, for both of these characters, because he becomes just overwhelmingly depressed. And she begins to kind of think, well, if we're the only two left, and I'm here with this man, but not only is he a man, he's a Black man, and he has different blood, and he has different, you know, almost like a different species, and I can't live here with him, and I have to run. And she's really terrified. Mm. And she, even in the beginning, she says that she doesn't really think of him as human. She says, you know, oh, you know, he's acting like a man, or he's acting kind of like a human. She kind of says these things thinking like, oh, this is really odd that he's behaving like a normal person would behave. This is supposed to be, you know, I've heard all these different things about them. Yeah. So this kind of turning point for both of them is, you know, he's depressed and she's kind of going back to her old way of thinking, and he wants to commit suicide, and she wants to run. And then, you know, right before she runs, he comes and kind of stops her. And there's this line that she says, and again, I probably have to go back and reread this to understand what was happening. And she's like, not this. And he's like, no, not this. So I don't know. That could mean a number of things.
Wait.
Me, I kind of want to think, I got to find it. I had it marked in here.
Now what do they say that in reference to again?
So she's trying to run from him, and he has the car, but he comes and he stops her and kind of has her get in the car, and she says, not this, and he says, no, not this. And I'm wondering, maybe it's a reference of thinking, you know, well, she's thinking he's going to harm her or hurt her or do something maybe sexual to her. And he's kind of saying, no, this isn't one
thing. Or like,
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Like, no, or we're not this, like not what you expect, not what it was before, like what you think would happen before. It doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly.
And she's sort of like realizing, oh, not this.
Like, yeah. No, that's kind of how I saw it, is though, as you know, he's kind of reassuring her that these fears that you have, this is what we're doing.
She can trust him, or she's dawning, her mind is opening to trust him.
Right. And then also she saves him because after they kind of realize like they can't reach anyone else and they may be the only people, he wants to jump in the river. He wants to just end it and say, listen, I think, and he doesn't say this, but you have the idea that maybe he believes that his family's gone, he's grieving, and he's like, there's just no point. And she stops him and she says, no, you're not allowed to do this. Like, we're gonna survive and we're gonna figure this out. And so they both have these kind of moments of panic where the other one, you know, brings the other one back to reality. And they begin to kind of, you see in their thought process that they're starting to kind of not see the same distinctions that they saw before.
Right.
And so they decide to, they've driven around for hours and they've tried to call and they've done all this stuff to try to find people. So they decide, they have these flares they found and they're just going to go and just live on this roof and occasionally shoot off flares. So they're on this roof, and this is kind of the interesting, one of the interesting parts of this story is they're just both laying on the roof and they're just both thinking. And Du Bois allows us to see kind of what they're both thinking. And the woman, again, we don't know her name either. She's has this revelation, right? That she's like, okay, I am the last woman on earth. That means that I am also the mother of civilization. Right. And she begins to have these really grand thoughts about herself, saying, I am just like, this is me. I'm going to be the one to restart humanity. And then she looks at him and she goes, and this is the father of humanity. And the two of us, we are going to just restart and repopulate the world, which is a really big switch from, you know, at the beginning of the story, you know, her thinking that he's not even human, and her being afraid that she's going to be raped or she's going to be harmed and trying to run away from him, to thinking they're just special chosen people who are going to restart humanity.
Okay.
And so then you kind of switch to his thoughts, okay, and he's having the same thoughts too. He's like, well, here we are. It's just me. It's just her. We can no longer really make these distinctions, don't matter anymore about race, about class. And I forgot, they had this whole conversation about what it was like for her to be wealthy and that she never had to work a day in her life and that he had to work every day of his life. And so they bring in class, the class struggle as well. But they make these, they both make these realizations kind of at the same time that none of these distinctions matter anymore. The race doesn't matter anymore. The class doesn't matter anymore. There's no more people, and they are the two that are going to restart civilization. And it's almost comical because they're just, you know, they're having these really grand and thoughts, and they're looking at each other as they're thinking this, and they literally like reach their arms out for each other. And all of a sudden you hear a honk, and it's almost funny because it's just, they have these thoughts and they're like, we are the father and we are the mother of civilization, and honk, and it's this car that they hear, and it literally just snaps them out. It's almost like a record scratch, you know. It's just stopped before they can, their arms can touch, before they can reach out to each other, this car shows up and it just snaps them out of this, like, immediately. Like, they just, it's over. All of that thought, all of this, the distinctions are gone. The, you know, the new world is beginning. Record scratch, over. Just like that. Exactly. It's done.
All right. So what's happening?
You know, so it turns out that I guess a rescue unit or something was sent to New York. Maybe they saw the flares. And her father, who's a bigwig, and I guess it's her fiance, her boyfriend, were looking for her. So they were alive and they find her. And they, you know, they're so happy to see her. But then they see him. And literally the fiance is going to shoot him with no questions asked. Like, he's going to pull the gun out and just shoot this man. you know, as this black man and this white woman, he must have been up to no good, had no intentions. And she's like, no, he saved me. He saved my life. He risked his life. He saved me. And he's like, okay, whatever. And the father gives him a few dollars, like, thanks. And they leave. But then you hear that all the rescue people who have come, because it turns out that the world is fine. Only New York has been devastated. So everyone in New York has died, but the rest of the world is fine. And they see him and they automatically start yelling like, N-word, yeah. Lynch him, we gotta kill him. You know, he must have been up to no good. And so they're automatically just brought back to what the world really is.
Right.
And the kind of strange thing that happened is then this woman appears. It's a black woman. And it turns out that it's his wife. And she has survived some kind of way. And she is found her way in the midst of all of these rescuers and what's happening. And she's holding with her a child, a dead baby. So his wife is alive, but his baby is dead. And she's carrying around this dead baby. And so I'm thinking what this means.
Is that the end?
That's pretty much the end.
I am worn out, Rhonda. That was I thought it was going to end with them reaching out to each other, and nope.
Right. No, so he reunites with his wife. It ends with this dead baby. It literally lacks the end that says, like, she has a dead baby in her arms. Is the last sentence of the story.
Mm.
And, you know, it's joyful because he finds his wife, but I'm thinking, is this dead baby representative of kind of a hopelessness?
I thought so too, because counterpointed with the sort of reverie of the two of the original pair reaching out to each other, going to start civilization over again. And now that baby is dead, or a baby is dead. And they certainly go back to the old social norms.
Right.
I mean, I was thinking a lot about when you were talking about how the lack of other people can lead to personal liberation. Like mm-hmm. when he first got out of the vault, like he was just like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm not going to take the train. I'll take the car. Like this sort of sense, like no people equals his liberation really. And it seemed like the two of them then eventually after struggles, were going to reach a sense of liberation together. And then people come back in. So like the more people, the more oppression.
Absolutely. Yeah, you see that. And I think we can even see it, I don't know, in current times, you know, if kind of the impact of the just, you know, the influence of different voices, right? You hear a lot about Facebook and Facebook groups, the influences of all these kind of different voices. And what would it be like if people didn't have all these different influences and voices and things that were interfering, you know, what would happen if people really, really were able to kind of think for themselves and really see things without all the other noise, which is impossible, you know, unless there's a comet that wipes all of us out, but just the opportunity to not have that pressure or to not have those influences. And also, it seems like they were both really kind of hopeful to start something new. So I thought that was interesting because all of this happens in a day.
Yeah.
And they go through such big transitions within this day. And it seems like they both lost, they thought that they had lost really important people. She thought she had lost just her father and fiance. We didn't know about his wife or his baby until the very end of the story, but apparently like he thought he had lost them, but they were kind of hopeful and ready to just start over. And then it's just over. Yeah. And everything automatically switches back. And they kind of, even Du Bois, when she tells her fiance, no, don't shoot him. This man risked his life and saved me. He makes a point of saying that she could not look at him.
Mm-hmm.
She was unable to look the man in his eyes. So again, wondering if that was just symbolizing that, you know, did she feel guilty? Did she feel ashamed that she had thought these things in the presence of her father and her fiance made her remember like, okay, this is my place. And what was I thinking? I don't know.
There's like, there's also another cultural reference. Like there's a movie from the 70s called Swept Away by Lena Wertmüller, a female director. And it's like two people get swept away and abandoned on a desert island. One a very rich woman and one a very poor guy. And
I've seen this, yeah.
Yeah, they develop a relationship and then they get saved, just like your story. And he's sort of like hoping they're going to continue. And she just sort of gets into the rich helicopter and flies away because she can't, even though she did before, she back in the real world, in quotes, she can't give in to him. She can't resist, I guess, the lure of money and status and just the power of what she's used to.
Right. And kind of as you were talking about in your book, maybe it's this idea of she held a very, very high position in the society that we currently live in. So that's not worth, you know, worth giving up.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I mean, you mentioned the Facebook and Twitter thing. Like I thought of that too with Hadrian, like if, like how we could have a sort of perceived insurrectionist executed, like with this panoply of voices, if Hadrian and Emperor was around, it would be, I realized it would be like a constant state of war. And he'd be constantly going after enemies left and right who were disagreeing with him or insurrectionists or just causing trouble. And then it made me also think that in some ways, like because of social media, we are at war. There is like a civil war going on. Mm. Because it's just, and it's almost never ending because it's like there will always be a voice that will foment something else. Right. That was off your topic, I think, of the story, but
or not even culture, you know. Because there's so many ways of communication now. You know, I mean, in the story when he first comes out of the vault and he's seeing all the dead people, like one of the things he sees is like the newsboy with all of the newspapers with the headline of Comet, you know.
Yeah.
And back then, you know, and the fact that they had to travel to they couldn't just go find a phone or didn't have a phone. They had to go to the switchboard place to make the calls, you know. But now there's communication and information. It's just so easy for it to come, which makes it, yeah, like you said.
Well, don't get me started because like they talk a lot about actually libraries and memoirs of Hadrian about how important. I mean, Hadrian basically says the most important thing in his life was books. And you could extrapolate and say the internet is also information. So that's why the internet's so important and people love it in some ways. But there was a sense of journey to a library, to a sacred place, to a book and opening that book and focusing on, it's about focus. We talk about this all the time. It's just that sort of pilgrimage to focus, which just doesn't really exist on the internet. But I am fascinated by that story. And it was called The Messenger?
It's called The Comet.
Oh, The Comet.
And they called him The Messenger. Oh.
Well, that's interesting because that really struck with me, the title, the idea of The Messenger.
Right. And that's how we just know. And she says his name. The wife says his name like the last page of the book. Yeah. I think it's Jim or something like that. But the whole story, we just know of him as either the man or the messenger.
I really wanted it to end with them on the roof.
I think Du Bois was kind of bringing us back to reality.
Yeah. Like,
no.
So not when the world ends and you and I are the only people alive.
You think we would be the only people?
Well, if I wrote the story or you did.
Okay.
Well, actually, if you wrote the story, you wouldn't choose me. I would choose you because you're my partner in stardom.
Right. And we would have more than enough time to read all the books we ever wanted to read.
I know. I wear glasses, so I have to be very careful.
I don't wear glasses.
Well, good for you. You could read to me.
I could, exactly.
You'd be the audiobook.
Exactly.
Oh. What a story. You're such a good storyteller. You know that?
Oh, thank you.
It just occurred to me. It just occurred to me.
Just occurred to me.
I mean, I'm like, you know, all over the place, but you can really tell a story because I was sort of like biting my nails.
You were like, what's going to happen?
I don't know. Made me excited. Cool. W.E.B. Du Bois, The Comet. Love it. Love it. Oh, so we also, I suppose it's time to tell everybody that the next book from the New York Public Library is 125 Books We Love. book that we're going to read is a book of poetry called American Primitive by Mary Oliver. And we're going to read, how should we do this? I think we should read certainly a couple of poems each, but we probably should read one poem that we both read. Should have one.
Yeah.
I guess I'll talk to you later. We'll email each other.
Yes, and, absolutely.
Yeah, and decide on that. And then, you know, you could pick your own. I'll pick my own and then we'll go from there. Does that sound good?
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah, Mary Oliver. I don't know a lot about her, but I'm eager to discover her. There's a couple of really good books of poetry on the 125 Books We Love list. One of which I'm going to mention because we're not going to read it together because I already discussed it on the podcast, but it's Autobiography of Red by Anne Carson, which also deals with mythological themes. Oh, so good. And one of the best discussions I had in my book discussion group. So that's Autobiography of Red by Anne Carson. But Rhonda and I are going to read Mary Oliver's American Primitive. December 3rd, that episode will be aired.
Yeah.
Anything else, darling, in your cultural world that you're intrigued by? Or I don't know, we've been talking for like 16 hours.
Yeah, I think I got it all out.
All right. I don't know. I always, always think when I start this is going to be a short one. And then I look.
You always say that.
I know. Well, I'm nothing if not a repeater. But anyway, and then I look at the clock. I'm like, we've been talking for over an hour. It's all about the editing, baby. All right. So until the next time, everybody, thank you so much for listening. And we really appreciate it. And hope you're all doing well and you're getting sleep and you're eating appropriately. I'm really missing the gym. I really need to move a little more, but I'll work on that.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Librarian Is In, a podcast by the New York Public Library. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, or send us an email at podcasts@nypl.org. For more information about the New York Public Library and our 125th anniversary, please visit nypl.org/125. We are produced by Christine Farrell. Your hosts are Frank Calarius and Rhonda Evans.